Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy connecting the like. My guest today is Anna Maria Hemingway, and we're going to discuss her book called Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, Stories of the Eternal Continuum of Consciousness. Are you there, Anna Maria?
I am.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I think the very first question most people would want to ask you is, what led you to write your book?
Well, it's sort of a long answer, actually, that I'll make short, but I went through an experience myself with my own mother when she was sick and making her own transition. And when I came to the end of that period, I realized that, you know, this had been a very profound journey for me, and it actually really illuminated the fact as well how unprepared we are to deal with death when it comes into our lives. And I felt very inspired to actually write of my own experience and collect, you know, many more and sort of open up this whole field of looking at death, perhaps becoming a little curious and looking at it in a slightly different way, expanding our awareness, and in order really to be helpful, in as much as, you know, I think it's the one topic that we're totally unprepared for and have very little guidance, you know, on how to deal with things. So in a nutshell, that's why I wrote the book.
Right, yes. What were your thoughts about death prior to that experience? I mean, did you believe in life after death?
I always have had a belief in the possibility of a continuum of consciousness following physical death. Not specifically through, at that time, you know, engaging with after-death communications or any of the things I write about, but I think more from the point of view that, you know, I just had that feeling, like most people do, and that curiosity. My feelings towards death prior to writing the book, I would say had changed actually a good deal, because I had actually been doing quite a lot of work in conscious dying and had worked in hospice, but prior to that, I think I was the same as everybody else, you know, really unprepared, shocked, and not really knowing how to deal with the deaths that actually, you know, came into my life.
Yes, yes. Why do you think that most people fear death?
Well, I think over time we've become so disconnected from the fact that death is actually a part of the natural cycle of life. And I like the fact that nowadays people are using more and more the term transition, you know, rather denoting that this is part of the journey rather than just a dead end. And I think that you know, as we've kind of come into this more material, you know, age, where we have a lot of scientific and medical technology, you know, people are looking more and more to prolong life at all costs. And, you know, often when nothing else can be done, we tend to look at death as being rather the ultimate failure rather than part of life. And I think, you know, it really has become pretty much a taboo subject. You know, people don't like to talk about someone that's died. They don't acknowledge the people that are left because they don't know what to say. They don't know how to deal with grief. And, you know, I think that what I tried to do, as I said earlier, was really to, you know, get people curious. And, you know, the book is by no means a morbid book. In fact, you know, most people find it to be uplifting and quite inspirational, because we have so much evidence around us that actually seems to indicate, you know, that death is not the final that we think it's cessation of life that we think it is. And
yes.
I think people actually, you know, are helped a lot by bringing that awareness back into their lives rather than, you know, ignoring the whole thing.
Yes, yes. I know what you mean, even amongst families, or perhaps more so, when you have the passing of one of the family members, it is difficult to talk about. And I guess that partly comes about because of the difference of opinion. I mean, some people don't believe there is anything after, and if you try to tell them there is something, sometimes they're fearful of what it's going to mean to them. So it is a very touchy subject, isn't it?
It is a very touchy subject, but I think, you know, the truth of the matter is this is a journey we're going to all be making, and also we have to deal with the painful loss of family, loved ones, even pets at some time during a lifetime, and there's no escape. So my feeling is actually wouldn't it be better to be a bit more prepared and, you know, really... The title of the book, which is Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, is really based upon that theme that in order to actually, you know, have a conscious life, you actually have to accept that death is part of that, and that actually death can be a motivating force in our lives, because I think for a lot of people, you know, we just see grief and suffering, and of course there is enormous grief and suffering, you know, when we lose somebody, but at the same time, you know, death strips away everything that's unimportant. So when we're with somebody, if we're kind of fully conscious, perhaps, you know, we can actually have a better relationship at that time with this person than we've ever had before. Or we can, you know, heal things in families. So there are all sorts of things that I think, you know, during this period that grace can enter our lives as well. And we actually get the opportunity to learn more about ourselves, what's really important to ourselves, and actually perhaps experience being our most authentic selves as well.
Yes, yes. So obviously with your own experience and the other investigations you've made with regards to other people, and that you tell us was near-death experiences or the actual death of family members, you're proving that death is only a transition, but what do you believe it goes on to do? I mean, is the experience of people beyond that? In other words, do you, for example, believe in reincarnation?
Well, from my own personal perspective, I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows for sure, what kind of an afterlife one could expect, and secondly, you know, how that would shape up. We just don't know the answer to that. I mean, that's one of the mysteries, but I think perhaps the nearest we get to perhaps figuring what that might be is from listening to stories of near-death experience survivors who actually perhaps get closer than anybody else does. And, you know, excuse me, these stories are all very consistent, and they all, you know, go through a tunnel, they all get brought forth into the light, they often have a life review, they describe seeing various religious entities or deceased friends and relatives, perhaps the whole cosmos, and sometimes are given information that they obviously had no idea of before. So it certainly seems that at the moment they are determined to be clinically dead, that their consciousness or spirit or essence, whatever you like to call it, certainly seems to leave the physical body, because, you know, they can often describe being in different places or talk about what was going on at the time, looking at their own dead body from above.
Yeah.
Witnessing conversations. So, you know, something very dramatic has happened here, and I think perhaps, for me, I'm not really so interested in proving one way or another. you know, how this phenomena is caused. What I am interested in is the fact that these people come back and they're a very, you know, there are huge changes in their personalities.
Yes.
They lose fear of the dying process. They seem to be very encouraged and motivated to make changes in their lives. Often their lives are, you know, perhaps service orientated.
Yes.
And they have a quality about them that is very different. So that's what's interesting to me, that, you know, concretely we can see some, you know, huge transformation has taken place.
Yes. I've also read on occasions that some people having a near-death experience, they like the feel and the freedom of being out of the physical body, and they actually want to stay on the other side. But they're told that they can't. It's not their time to be there permanently, which I think must be reassuring, because it tends to tell you that there is a sense of purpose and meaning in your life.
Well, I think so. I think, you know, if we look back in history, we can go back as far as Plato, or even earlier than that, to the 8th century, when, you know, the English St. Bede actually wrote a history of the English church and people at the time, and actually had a near-death experience in his research at the time. And in both these instances, Plato as well, you know, a near-death experience is actually related, and one of the major points of it is the fact that, you know, it's a lesson to leading a more meaningful life. So that idea is, you know, when we hear it now in modern day near-death experiences, is not a new thing at all. Near-death experiences have been recorded for centuries, but the message is always the same message. And as you say, a lot of these people, you know, they don't want to leave that place. They're in this blissful situation. They may feel the weightlessness, or however they describe it, and then suddenly, you know, a voice telepathically communicates with them to say, you have to go back. And most of them are very upset at the idea of having to go back.
Yeah.
But again, you know, like you mentioned, they're asked to go back because they have something specific to do. And most of them, you know, find that out when they do return to their physical body.
Yes. So that type of evidence would prove that the experience is not simply an internal one within your consciousness. It is actually something that occurs outside of you. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would. And, you know, I write in the book quite a bit about deathbed visions. Again, it should have very similar components to the NDE. I mean, you know, the dying person will often see a religious entity again, or a deceased relative or friend saying that they will be there to escort them on their journey. They often get glimpses of what an apparent, you know, afterlife state could be like. And I don't think these things are separate things. I think they're all just peering over this veil of consciousness and, you know, getting these glimpses of another reality. And certainly, you know, for these people, these episodes are really very reassuring and calming. And we can go back through history with the end-of-life visions. You know, it's not a new thing. Supposedly, Jesus actually appeared to Mary to tell her that he would be returning at the hour of her death to personally escort her. So even in myth, you know, going right back to the Greek and Roman myths, we have this idea of the psychopomp, or the transitional guide that will be there to accompany the soul. So it seems a very deep-rooted idea that is actually lodged already in our consciousness. But as I said earlier, you know, I think we've lost touch with so much of that that we don't just sort of accept it as part of our consciousness anymore. I think we have to reclaim it.
Yes. Yes, I agree. Now, in your investigations into these type of incidents, did you find that any of the Orthodox religions come very near to what the death experience really is?
Well, I think obviously, you know, there are Eastern religions, you know, that believe in the concept of reincarnation. Certainly, again, going back to, you know, the early Greeks, they believed in this idea of choosing a new life. Religions in general, for me, I think all seem to pretty much state some kind of belief in some after-death state of some kind, and they obviously all have their own variations. But I think part of the interesting thing for me is that, you know, we see this common thread running through all religious, or many religious, you know, holy texts and scriptures, going right back to the Egyptians, the Greeks, even the Mayan Book of the Dead. And we get this same kind of idea running through. But I think, you know, it's human beings actually form religions. You know, the sacred message is there. It's always reinterpreted by human beings. And, you know, I think that's when we get unstuck a bit.
Yes, I'm sure you're right there. Now, just coming to your book, what is the most influential story that you have in there of a near-death experience? Because I know you tend to favour one particular one. Would you like to tell us a bit about that? And I'm thinking, of course, of Larry Hagman's.
It is. The first section of the book is about near-death experiences, and, you know, Larry's story is in that section. And one of the reasons that I found it to be most interesting is because he really reiterates the message of the NDE. You know, Larry, better known as JR to many people, is a person that has acquired what most people believe to be the essential things in life, money, power, success, fame. But, you know, Larry still had this nagging realization, like I think we all do, that that wasn't enough, and that, you know, acquiring those things was all very nice and makes life a bit more pleasant, but it actually doesn't provide any of the answers to the deeper meaning in life. And it actually led him into a depressed state, and it was through his NDE like experiences that he came to the realization, like many other survivors of this type of experience do, that it did give him the answer he was looking for. He realized that for him, you know, we don't disappear when we die. We go on to other levels of existence, that he was no longer afraid of dying. And actually does spend, you know, a lot of his time now, like many other people who have shared this type of phenomenon, in charitable work, and undertakes, you know, a lot in that area. So I think his story is interesting from that perspective, because in the world we live now in, you know, we really tend to, a lot of people anyway, focus on the idea of material success being it. But of course, you know, we go back to that older saying, you know, you can't take it with you when you die. But what are you going to take, you know?
Well, what are you going to do with it when you've got it?
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, there are other experiences, generally called out-of-the-body experiences, which I guess come into your category, but do you consider them to also be proof of what you're trying to convey to people?
Yes, I think they are. To me, all experiences that alter consciousness, you know, are really taking us to the same place. People can have very many similar visions, for example, during a meditation, or an out-of-body experience that doesn't necessarily have to be anything to do with a near-death experience, but nevertheless, there are, you know, insights that are gained. I mean, some people will get the same kind of imagery and understanding, or certainly did in the days when it was legal, and there were actually experiments done by the Groff with, you know, psychedelic drugs. It really is to do with that place of altering consciousness. And obviously this can be achieved in many different ways. I think perhaps one of the differences is that, you know, if one was to go into meditation or even to experiment, you would actually be going out and trying to get that effect in some way, working towards that.
Yes,
whereas
yes.
with an NDE or just sudden out-of-body experience, you're not. You know, one minute you're driving around in your car or whatever it is you're doing in your life, and the next minute something happens and the trauma or whatever it is has shocks the person, propels the person, you know, into an altered state. And often for an NDE person, it could have been the result of an accident or whatever it is, but certainly because at that particular moment they are actually deemed to be clinically dead. And I think another interesting point about the NDE is that, you know, people can be unconscious from 2 or 3 minutes up to an hour in some cases. And normally, you know, we would expect brain injury after the brain has been starved of oxygen for a very short time. But actually these people come back and they have enhanced brain and memory functioning. So, again, that's a sort of other little extraordinary, you know, thing to consider too.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't too long ago that I read of a story where a woman was in a car with a child, actually, and it went off a roadway into a very deep pond or river, and she was trapped in that car for quite a long time before she was rescued, and she came out of it with total memory recall. There didn't seem to be any damage at all, so that's another instance of what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I'd like to come to here is, it would appear, certainly it would seem so from what you've said, that most of these experiences are of a pleasant nature, but have you come across any near-death experiences where they have been unpleasant? I mean, what I'm looking at is, if you have realms of bliss, are there realms also that you might call of hell? I mean, has anybody you've contacted had a bad experience?
I don't actually have. I mean, I talk about negative NDEs in the book. I think that we don't tend to hear so much about them, and obviously there are negative NDEs, but there are, you know, far more positive ones and negative. Now, you know, some people will look at this from a psychological point of view and, you know, take Jung's idea of the shadow and suggest that a negative NDE is confronting that shadow and may describe it as a sort of shocking wake-up call. You know, they're not living the life they're meant to live, perhaps. Some people also in this category may have tried to take their own lives, and rather than have, you know, the full-blown experience, because, you know, during an NDE, I think it's important to remember that people actually do go through the dark tunnel before they come into the light, and this light and darkness plays, you know, a very important part, and it does in much literature around all these types of apparitions and phenomena. But I think, you know, that could be one plausible explanation. Often these people, during their NDE that may be negative, you know, pray or call out for help, and the experience does turn into a benign one after that. You know, once they've almost like turned around, as it were.
Yes, yes.
Some people would say that they haven't gone far into the experience enough, and they have become just stuck in that initial phase. And, you know, why exactly that would be, we don't know. But there are people, you know, like a couple of really well-known cases, like the Reverend Howard Storm, who, you know, was a total agnostic, I suppose you would call him, or atheist. Yeah. He had a negative NDE, and, you know, he actually came through it and is now a pastor and spreading the word. So I don't think it has to actually stay as a negative source. Some people do actually have just an experience where they've become afraid and have a tough time integrating that. But, you know, there is a mystery attached to all of this. We can speculate as much as we like. We do see the results of people who have had a negative near-death experience, and they actually have positively transformed their lives in the end. There are some people that just retain the images of something that, you know, wasn't very pleasant. And I think to a certain extent, you know, we are confronting ourselves, perhaps.
Yeah.
And, you know, there may be many explanations for that. If you went to, you know, Eastern philosophies, people might talk about karma or past lives, or really don't know the answer. Just possible solutions.
How many times in your experience of interviewing other people did you find that when they had a near-death experience, they actually met members of their family that had already passed over? I mean, was that a regular feature?
It all depends. I mean, there's a list of core components to a near-death experience, and some people can have every single one of them, and some people have some and not others, and they can, you know, differ in the order that they take place. Now, some people definitely do see deceased relatives. They go through the tunnel, and at the end of the tunnel will be, you know, their father or their mother or even their dog. So some people will see, a deceased relative or friend or loved one. Other people might see Jesus or an angel.
Yeah.
Some people just describe it as a source of light, you know. They don't have any particular imagery associated. So again, it seems to vary on who a person will be met by, but, you know, the main thing again there is that they're met by somebody.
Yeah.
You know?
There is a school of thought that when you first meet anyone after you've passed over, it will, generally speaking, be someone that you have a love link with. Now, it would seem in that event that the same thing applies to near-death experiences in view of what you've just said. So that seems to rather confirm it, yeah.
And also, you know, the same happens in, you know, the deathbed visions. For my mother, it was her father. Now, again, you know, some people with deathbed visions, they may see a deceased relative or friend, or some of them may again see an angel, or Mary, or some religious figure.
Well, that's what made me think of it, because you mentioned, obviously, for example, some people are met by Jesus, and I guess what has happened there is their life is spent more with a religious understanding, and therefore their concept of what happens after death is that they're going to meet an entity like Jesus. So that is right for them.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's, you know, a very important point that you raised, because, you know, if for example, an Indian person was to have a near-death experience, they would be seeing one of the gods that symbolized that consciousness for them. If it was
right,
a Muslim,
yeah,
they'd be seeing Allah. You know, if it's a Christian, they may see Jesus. So I think that from what we can see, it's almost your own mythography, if you like, your own mythic cultural belief system actually seems to, you know, lend itself into translating this image into your, into what would symbolize that for each individual.
Yes, I think you're entirely right there. Now, some people might be a little puzzled by the part of the title of your book that refers to conscious dying. Now, would you like to tell us what that means?
Well, I think there's two parts to that. One is what I touched on, you know, earlier in the conversation, which is that in order to practice conscious living, we have to have an awareness of death as being part of our life cycle. Not only because does that idea, you know, give us the idea of actually living consciously and well in the present moment, but because it also encompasses the fact that we are not, you know, just the body we're living in or just the characteristics we've picked up, that we are, you know, on an eternal journey, and that at some point this transition will be made, so we don't identify solely with our ego-based self, if you like.
Yes.
That's, you know, that's one part of conscious living and dying, and the other part really is to be conscious of the fact of how would we make, personally, make that transition ourselves? How are we going to deal with people around us that may be making that transition? How can we do that in a conscious manner? And of course, that is part of conscious living. So really, it's to do with, you know, not identifying with that idea of that body, and also being aware and being able to deal with death consciously, knowing that it's a part of life.
Yeah, yeah. Without that, I guess the fear factor comes in, particularly if someone is, say, unsure if there is a God and things like that, whether there is such a thing as a judgment day. The unknown factors of death, I could well understand, could be quite frightening to some people.
Well, I think, you know, they're frightening for the majority of people because we have lost that kind of sense of connection that, you know, I think people of earlier civilizations had. For example, if we go back to the Egyptians, you know, they spent their lives preparing for death or an afterlife state, and so did many other, you know, different peoples of those times. So they had a very different concept. We don't it's not part of our consciousness to think about, know, making any form of movement, you know. So I think we have a much harder time with it, and that's why so many people are afraid. And, you know, you're right, people are afraid, and, you know, they really don't know very much about how to possibly change that for themselves. And, you know, that's actually why I put the book together, because, you know, I think it's necessary to reconnect with a lot of different material and you know, different personal experiences from people that actually show a kind of different, you know, that although all that's going on, you know, the enormity surrounding that part of life, there is something else going on too. And, you know, like with everything else, you know, the greater part I think about during the dying process, the greater thing that happens is invisible. You know, we only see the outer the outer sort of manifestation. And for many people, especially if a person has been really sick, you know, it's a very scary and painful thing to do.
Yes, indeed. And I think the comfort that people would derive from understanding the continuity of life would be particularly helpful in families where, as sometimes happens, they lose one of their children at a very early age, because the pain of losing a young child must be one of the worst that you can experience, I would think.
Well, I certainly agree with you. I mean, you know, I have a couple of stories in my book. They're not actually in the near-death experience section, but in the middle section regarding this very point. And, you know, how do we get through grief and actually transform ourselves and transform that grief? Well, people do that, you know. And the couple of stories that I've actually have in the book, you know, I think are a great source of inspiration, because, for example, you know, Joanne's story in my book about, you know, losing her stillborn daughter really plunged her again into the deepest despair. Coming through that eventually, she, you know, realized how many other people were in the same boat and that there were no real resources for them. And, you know, set up what has now become an international, worldwide, huge organization that actually does that. And, you know, in a sense, for Joanne, it's like a near-death experience. So she found her mission and purpose through, you know, perhaps what we wouldn't expect that to be the result.
I guess a lot of that, this sort of uncertainty, has to do with the fact that people do have so many different views about what happens when you pass over. So it's very difficult, I guess, for someone to know which advice to accept.
Well, I think so, and I think that's why, certainly for me, I was very interested to look at, you know, as many different belief systems as I could. And, you know, my conclusion at the end was that, you know, really, they're all saying the same thing, whether you're reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead or, you know, whether you're reading a near-death experience. We're getting the same kind of information. How we translate that personally, you know, may well depend on our own religious experiences. And certainly, you know, having a religious conviction in your life isn't necessary to have an NDE or any of the other things that we've just been talking about. You know, many of these people don't. But interestingly enough, you know, they describe themselves as certainly being more spiritual afterwards. I'm not saying they necessarily rush off and join the nearest church.
No.
They just have a spirituality.
Yes, yes. Now, I interviewed a lady not too many weeks ago whose husband passed over, and subsequently he came to her quite often and he gave her messages which she received in her head, shall we say, and little things happened around her that convinced her that he was in her presence. Now, how often did you find that came up? I mean, where people spoke of the death of someone around them and then believed that they continued to contact them?
Well, I found it to be very common. And what I found to be interesting, actually, was that when you give people, you know, the opportunity in the forum to discuss something like that, you often find people that would never have mentioned it before saying things like, "Oh, yes, well, you know, that happened when my mother died. You know, I smelt her perfume," or there was something so synchronistic just to do with her that I knew it had to be a message from her. So I think on some level that we all actually, you know, experience things. In my experience anyway, and I would sort of broaden that to, you know, the question I often ask people when they sort of try putting it in a box as to do with religion or, you know, or I don't believe in an after-death communication or anything like that. And, you know, my question is, well, have you ever had anything happen in your life that's had a profound effect on you, but you can't rationally explain? And I haven't met anybody yet who said no. And I think if we all look at our own lives and, you know, the instances that we've had those kind of experiences, that we all kind of, you know, get a glimpse of that place. And after-death communication, you know, it is the third section in my book, and it really not only traces the history of, you know, after-death communication and what it could mean, but actual instances of, you know, normal, everyday people, not, you know, you don't have to be a medium or you don't have to do anything. Anyone can actually, you know, have very meaningful after-death communication that certainly assures them that that has been real and that they've, you know, sometimes had a message or something very pertinent that they know it is the person.
Yes, indeed. Now, we're not too far away from the end of the program in as much that I have to allow the last 5 minutes to go to the studio, and I also want to allow you time to talk about where people can purchase your book. But what message would you give to people who are ill and maybe having to think about the possibility of passing on, or have someone around them facing death? I mean, what could they do to help those people, or themselves for that matter?
Well, I think actually if we can overcome our fear, this perhaps is for more with somebody that's perhaps having to go through, you know, what is a very painful situation with somebody that they love, is to really be fully present. You know, I think one of the most important things is that we go into these situations and there is a lot of pain and suffering, and sometimes we tend to forget that there can still be beautiful and wonderful moments to be shared. I think that's very important. And the second thing, I think, is really, you know, finding out more, looking at this whole idea of death and what it could mean, and, you know, perhaps even reading books like mine. I mean, that's the actual reason I wrote it, was because I realized there was such a gap. And like I say, although my journey, you know, with my own mother was very painful, nevertheless, it gave birth to this book. And I did experience many of the things that we've been discussing. So for me, you know, I found them to be true. And I think that other people can as well. And that if we expand our knowledge a little, you know, it can bring comfort all round, and also sort of a belief in the fact that, you know, we're not just facing a dead end and that's all there is. I mean, there's plenty of evidence that points strongly, you know, to a continuum. But I think for people who actually are with somebody, that it is really helpful, you know, to be as present with them. And certainly if they have things like, you know, deathbed visions and that, to be actively supportive rather than dismissing everything, which is another thing that we tend to do.
I think one of the most wonderful things that comes out of this is that, firstly, you realise there must be some purpose to life. And secondly, when you lose someone, you do know that somewhere you're likely to meet those same dear loved ones again, and that must give you a lot of comfort.
Yes, I think so. And like I say, you know, many, many people do have these kind of experiences, you know, every day.
Yes. Now, you've mentioned near-death experiences, the deathbed visions, and the after-death communication. What do all of those share in common, in your view?
Well, I think what they share in common is this idea that, you know, we do get opportunities to penetrate our everyday consciousness, and all of those phenomena are actually, you know, saying the same thing, basically. There is another, a realm, you know, another state of consciousness, and each of these particular topics that we've been talking about allows access to those different realms.
Yes. Well, that's very nice. Now, it might be a good time here for you to tell our listeners or confirm the title of your book and tell them how they can obtain a copy.
Yes, I'd love to do that. The book is actually called Practicing Conscious Living and Dying. It's published by O Books, which is www.o-books.net. It's actually available from any good bookstore in the English-speaking world in Europe, and you know, can be purchased off any of the Amazon sites or Barnes and Noble, many different you know, book chains and bookstores. So it's pretty easy to get hold of.
Yeah. You originally told me that you had a publishing date for January of this year. Did it actually come out during that month?
It did. It was actually came out, I think it was the 31st of January in the UK.
All right. Okay.
And maybe a few days earlier in the United States.
Yeah. That's fine, because that clearly means that there should be ample copies available. And for your information and our listeners, I will tell you that when I do my archive report, which goes on to the BBS radio website, I will mention these details in case people didn't get an opportunity to write everything down. So they will know how to get hold of your books.
Oh, that's great.
Yes, well, that's fine. So, as a result of all this, Koo, I think we can safely say from your point of view that you face life with peace and happiness because you've become consciously aware of the truth about death.
Well, I think so, but I'd like to reiterate here that, you know, I certainly do have that belief, but I'm not pretending for a moment that, you know, if somebody near to me is making that transition, I'm going to go through those periods of grief, you know, just as much. Because I think, you know, as human beings, what we actually mourn most is the physical, everyday presence of someone in our lives. And, you know, losing that is a big thing, and there's no easy way to do that. So, I never try and pretend that we're going to just sail through that without feeling all of those human emotions. But I certainly think that if you have some belief in the fact that, you know, the person is still with you in some form and that it is possible to communicate with them, you know, that certainly does help a lot in the healing processes that, you know, we go through.
Indeed. This is only out of interest now. I ask you, following on this, are you likely to delve into any other aspect of this subject and perhaps write another book?
Yes, I will be writing another book. I'm not exactly sure, you know, when that's going to be finished, but it will be to do with this idea of a continuum of consciousness that, you know, I've looked upon it this time, in this book, you know, focused around the dying process, because I think that's a topic that, you know, many people are very interested in at the present time. But I want to expand that into other areas.
Have you already decided some of the areas that you will go into?
Well, what I'm actually looking at the moment is, you know, all the life situations that can actually, you know, change our consciousness, and that can be from serious illness to even falling in love or all sorts of many different things that shift our everyday awareness and consciousness and give us these same glimpses. So, you know, that's the sort of topic that I'm interested in right now.
Would that include what we generally call dreams?
Certainly can do, yes. I think, you know, we live our life in this sort of everyday state of going to work, getting up, cooking the dinner and whatever, but at the same time, you know, we're operating on many different levels, and I think, you know, dreams are interesting because often after-death communication can take place in dreams, and I think one of the reasons that dreaming is such an important way of expanding consciousness is because, you know, when we're asleep, our natural defenses to gleaning any other kind of information is actually lowered, so we're more open and receptive than we are in our everyday waking state.
Yes. Well, I should think that would open up the door to a lot of interesting information. Certainly, just speaking for myself very briefly, I think the quality in dreams where if you have a specific experience, you just know that it's not your normal silly type of dream where nothing makes a lot of sense. Sometimes you get very definite experiences, and I think they do impinge on your consciousness.
Oh, very much so. Very much so.
Well, I wish you every luck in getting some more orders for your book, and particularly with your investigation into further subjects to write yet another book, because I've come to the point in the programme where I must thank you very much for coming on to it. You certainly know what you're talking about from your own point of view. It's been a very interesting programme, and I'm sure our listeners would agree. So thank you very much for being with us. So I'll now tell our listeners who I've got coming on next week, and that will be a lady called Toni Petrinovich, and she has memories of a past life as Sarah, the daughter of Jesus, and she also has another interest in the orbs of light that people often see. She has photographs of them, and she has actually communicated with them. She's got another side of her where she's interested in enlightenment and ascension. So I think that will be a very interesting program. So thank you for being with me today, and I hope you'll be with me next Friday. God bless you all. Thank you.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.